Chapter 10. In the private dining room, the dinner party was in the best of spirits. Samuel Wolcott was happy. Across the table from him was Miss Virginia St. Clair, radiant, a tinge of color in her cheeks. On either side, Mrs. Miriam Stuyvesant and Marshall St. Clair were brilliant and lighthearted. Wolcott looked at the young girl, and the measure of his worship was full. He wondered for the thousandth time how she could possibly love him, and by what earthly miracle as he had come to accept him, and how it would be always to have her across the table from him, his own table in his own house. They were about to rise from the table when one of the waiters entered the room and handed Wolcott an envelope. He thrust it quickly into his pocket. In the confusion of rising, the others did not notice him, but his face was ash white, and his hands trembled violently as he placed the wraps around the bewitching shoulders of Miss St. Clair. "Marshall," he said, and despite the powerful effort his voice was hollow, "you will see the lady safely cared for. I am called to attend a grave matter." "All right, Wolcott," answered the young man, with cheery good nature. "You are too serious, old man. Trot along." "The poor dear," murmured Mrs. Stuyvesant, after Wolcott had helped them to the carriage, and turned to go up the steps of the club. "The poor dear is hard hit, and men are such funny creatures when they are hard hit." Samuel Wolcott, as his fate would, went direct to the private writing room, and opened the door. The lights were not turned on, and in the dark he did not see Mason motionless by the mantel shelf. He went quickly across the room to the writing table, turned on one of the lights, and, taking the envelope from his pocket, tore it open. Then he bent down by the light to read the contents. As his eyes ran over the paper, his jaw fell. The skin drew away from his cheekbones, and his face seemed literally to sink in. His knees gave way under him, and he would have gone down in a heap had it not been for Mason's long arms that closed around him and held him up. The human economy is ever mysterious. The moment the new danger threatened, the latent power of the man as an animal, hidden away in the centers of intelligence, asserted itself. His hand clutched the paper, and, with a half slide, he turned in Mason's arms. For a moment he stared up at the ugly man whose thin arms felt like wire ropes. "You are under the dead fall, I," said Mason. "The cunning of my enemy is sublime." "Your enemy?" gasped Wolcott. "And did you come into it? How in God's name did you know it? How your enemy?" Mason looked down at the wide bulging eyes of the man. "Who should know better than I?" he said. "Haven't I broken through all the traps and plots that she could set?" "She? She trap you?" The man's voice was full of horror. "The old schemer," muttered Mason. "He cowardly old schemer, to strike in the back. But we can beat her. She did not count on my helping you, I, who know her so well." Mason's face was red, and his eyes burned. In the midst of it all he dropped his hands, and went over to the fire. Samuel Wolcott arose, panting, and stood looking at Mason, with his hands behind him on the table. The naturally strong nature and the rigid school in which the man had been trained presently began to tell. His composure in part returned, and he thought rapidly. What did this strange man know? Was he simply making shrewd guesses, or had he some mysterious knowledge of this matter? Wolcott could not know that Mason meant only fate, that he believed her to be his great enemy. Wolcott had never before doubted his own ability to meet any emergency. This mighty jerk had carried him off his feet. He was unstrung and panic-stricken. At any rate, this man had promised help. He would take it. He put the paper and envelope carefully into his pocket, smoothed out his rumpled coat, and going over to Mason, touched him on the shoulder. "Come," he said, "if you are to help me, we must go." The man turned, and followed him without a word. In the hall, Mason put on his hat and overcoat, and the two went out into the street. Wolcott hailed a cab, and the two were driven to his house on the avenue. Wolcott took out his latchkey, opened the door, and led the way into the library. He turned on the light and motioned Mason to seat himself at the table. Then he went into another room, and presently returned with a bundle of papers and a decanter of brandy. He poured out a glass of the liquor, and offered it to Mason. The man shook his head. Wolcott poured the contents of the glass down his own throat. Then he set the decanter down, and drew up a chair on the side of the table opposite Mason. "Sir," said Wolcott, in a voice deliberate, indeed, but as hollow as a sepulcher, "I am done for. God has finally gathered up the ends of the net, and it is knotted tight. Am I not here to help you?" said Mason, turning savagely. "Can beat fate. Give me the details of her trap." He bent forward, and rested his arms on the table. His streaked gray hair was rumpled and on end, and his face was ugly. For a moment Wolcott did not answer. He moved a little into the shadow, then he spread the bundle of old yellow papers out before him. "To begin with," he said, "I am a living lie, a gilded crime made sham, every bit of me. There is not an honest piece anywhere. It is all lie. I am a liar and a thief before men. The property which I possess is not mine, but stolen from a dead man. The very name which I bear is not my own, but is the bastard child of a crime. I am more than all that. I am a murderer before the law, a murderer before God, and worse than a murderer before the pure woman whom I love more than anything that God could make." He paused for a moment, and wiped the perspiration from his face. "Sir," said Mason, "this is all drivel, infantile drivel. What you are, is of no importance. How to get out is the problem, how to get out." Samuel Wolcott leaned forward, poured out a glass of brandy and swallowed it. "Well," he said, speaking slowly, "my right name is Richard Warren. In the spring of 1879 I came to New York, and fell in with the real Samuel Wolcott, a young man with a little money, and some property which his grandfather had left him. We became friends, and concluded to go to the Far West together. Accordingly we scraped together what money we could lay our hands on, and landed in the gold mining regions of California. We were young and inexperienced, and our money went rapidly. One April morning we drifted into a little shack camp, away up in the Sierra Nevadas, called Hell's Elbow. Here we struggled and starved for perhaps a year. Finally, in utter desperation, Wolcott married the daughter of a Mexican gambler, who ran an eating house and a poker joint. With them we lived from hand to mouth in a wild, God-forsaken way for several years. After a time the woman began to take a strange fancy to me. Wolcott finally noticed it, and grew jealous. One night, in a drunken brawl, we quarreled, and I killed him. It was late at night, and, beside the woman, there were four of us in the poker room: the Mexican gambler, a half-breed devil called Cherubim Pete, Wolcott, and myself. When Wolcott fell, the half-breed whipped out his weapon, and fired at me across the table. But the woman, Nina San Croix, struck his arm, and, instead of killing me, as he intended, the bullet mortally wounded her father, the Mexican gambler. I shot the half-breed through the forehead, and turned round, expecting the woman to attack me. On the contrary, she pointed to the window, and bade me wait for her on the cross trail below. It was fully 3 hours later before the woman joined me at the place indicated. She had a bag of gold dust, a few jewels that belonged to her father, and a package of papers. I asked her why she had stayed behind so long, and she replied that the men were not killed outright, and that she had brought a priest to them, and waited until they had died. This was the truth, but not all the truth. Moved by superstition or foresight, the woman had induced the priest to take down the sworn statements of the two dying men, seal it, and give it to her. This paper she brought with her. All this I learned afterwards. At the time I knew nothing of this damning evidence. We struck out together for the Pacific coast. The country was lawless. The privations we endured were almost past belief. At times the woman exhibited cunning and ability that were almost genius, and through it all, often in the very fingers of death, her devotion to me never wavered. It was dog-like, and seemed to be her only object on Earth. When we reached San Francisco, the woman put these papers into my hands. Wolcott took up the yellow package, and pushed it across the table to Mason. She proposed that I assume Wolcott's name, and that we come boldly to New York and claim the property. I examined the papers, found a copy of the will by which Wolcott inherited the property, a bundle of correspondence, and sufficient documentary evidence to establish his identity beyond the shadow of a doubt. Desperate gambler as I now was, I quailed before the daring plan of Nina San Croix. I urged that I, Richard Warren, would be known, that the attempted fraud would be detected, and would result in investigation, and perhaps unearth the whole horrible matter. The woman pointed out how much I resembled Wolcott, what vast changes 10 years of such life as we had led would naturally be expected to make in men, how utterly impossible it would be to trace back the fraud to Wolcott's murder at Hell's Elbow, in the wild passes of the Sierra Nevadas. She bade me remember that we were both outcasts, both crime-branded, both enemies of man's law and God's, that we had nothing to lose. We were both sunk to the bottom. Then she laughed, and said that as he had not found me a coward until now, but that if I had turned chicken-hearted, that was the end of it, of course. The result was, we sold the gold dust and jewels in San Francisco, took on such evidences of civilization as possible, and purchased passage to New York on the best steamer we could find. I was growing to depend on the bold gambler spirit of this woman, Nina San Croix. I felt the need of her strong, profligate nature. She was of a queer breed and a queer school. Her mother was the daughter of a Spanish engineer, and had been stolen by the Mexican, her father. She herself had been raised and educated as best might be in one of the monasteries along the Rio Grande, and had there grown to womanhood before her father, fleeing into the mountains of California, carried her with him. When we landed in New York, I offered to announce her as my wife, but she refused, saying that her presence would excite comment, and perhaps attract the attention of Wolcott's relatives. We therefore arranged that I should go alone into the city, claim the property, and announce myself as Samuel Wolcott, and that she should remain under cover until such time as we would feel the ground safe under us. Every detail of the plan was fatally successful. I established my identity without difficulty, and secured the property. It had increased vastly in value, and I, as Samuel Wolcott, soon found myself a rich man. I went to Nina San Croix in hiding, and gave her a large sum of money, with which she purchased a residence in a retired part of the city, far up in the northern suburb. Here she lived secluded and unknown, while I remained in the city, living here as a wealthy bachelor. I did not attempt to abandon the woman, but went to her from time to time in disguise, and under cover of the greatest secrecy. For a time everything ran smooth. The woman was still devoted to me above everything else, and thought always of my welfare first, and seemed content to wait so long as I thought best. My business expanded. I was sought after and consulted and drawn into the higher life of New York, and more felt that the woman was an albatross on my neck. I put her off with one excuse after another. Finally, she began to suspect me, and demanded that I should recognize her as my wife. I attempted to point out the difficulties. She met them all by saying that we should both go to Spain, there I could marry her, and we could return to America and drop into my place in society without causing more than a passing comment. I concluded to meet the matter squarely once for all. I said that I would convert half of the property into money and give it to her, but that I would not marry her. She did not fly into a storming rage as I had expected, but went quietly out of the room, and presently returned with two papers, which she read. One was the certificate of her marriage to Wolcott duly authenticated. The other was the dying statement of her father, the Mexican gambler, and of Samuel Wolcott, charging me with murder. It was in proper form and certified by the Jesuit priest. Now, apostrophe she said, sweetly, when as he had finished, which do you prefer, to recognize your wife, or to turn all the property over to Samuel Wolcott's widow, and hang for his murder? Apostrophe apostrophe, I was dumbfounded and horrified. I saw the trap that I was in, and I consented to do anything she should say, if she would only destroy the papers. This she refused to do. I pleaded with her, and implored her to destroy them. Finally she gave them to me with a great show of returning confidence, and I tore them in 2 bits, and threw them into the fire. That was 3 months ago. We arranged to go to Spain, and do as she said. She was to sail this morning, and I was to follow. Of course I never intended to go. I congratulated myself on the fact that all trace of evidence against me was destroyed, and that her grip was now broken. My plan was to induce her to sail, believing that I would follow. When she was gone I would marry Miss St. Clair, and if Nina St. Croix should return I would defy her, and lock her up as a lunatic. But I was reckoning like an infernal ass, to imagine for a moment that I could thus hoodwink such a woman as Nina St. Croix. Tonight I received this. Wolcott took the envelope from his pocket, and gave it to Mason. Who saw the effect of it? Read it and you will understand why. I felt the death hand, when I saw her writing on the envelope. Mason took the paper from the envelope. It was written in Spanish, and ran. Greeting to Richard Warren. The great singer does his little Nina injustice to think she would go away to Spain, and leave him to the beautiful American. She is not so thoughtless. Before she goes, she shall be, oh so very rich. And the dear singer shall be, oh so very safe. The Archbishop and the kind church hate murderers. Nina St. Croix. Of course, fool, the papers you destroyed were copies. NSNC. To this was pinned a line in a delicate aristocratic hand saying that the Archbishop would willingly listen to Madame St. Croix's statement if she would come to him on Friday morning at 11. You see, said Wolcott, desperately, there is no possible way out. I know the woman, when she decides to do a thing, that is the end of it. As he has decided to do this. Mason turned around from the table, stretched out his long legs. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.